Great. Hi, everybody. Thank you for joining us today on the call. My name is Michelle Mittelstadt. I'm the Communications Director at the Migration Policy Institute. And we thought it would be helpful with the 10-year anniversary of 9/11 coming up to, help sort of look at all of the changes that have happened in the U.S. immigration system and how it has evolved in terms of really program and budget and organizational changes and policy changes that have occurred as a direct outgrowth of the 9/11 attacks. So we prepared a fact sheet, which we released earlier this week and which you can find on our website, migrationpolicy.org. And anyhow, just wanted to offer you the opportunity today to hear from Doris Meisner, who heads our U.S. Immigration Policy Program and who was Commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service during the 1990s, and from Muzaffar Chishti, who directs MPI's office in New York at NYU School of Law. Both of them co-authored the fact sheet, and we'll be making some comments, and then we'll open it up for your questions. So, Doris, we can go ahead and start with you.
Okay, thank you, and good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us for this call and this briefing. I'm going to start with the obvious point, but it is the key point that we have to start with in assessing the impact of the 9/11 experience on immigration. And that starting point is that the hijackers got to the United States with properly issued visas. So that meant that the immigration system and immigration procedures from the start were inextricably linked with the 9/11 experience, and immigration since then and still today is seen as an essential element of the nation's response and protection against terrorism. Now, that linkage is not a new one. It's always been there, partially in our immigration statutes. It certainly was felt strongly within the culture and in the institution of the INS, the immigration agency, and the visa and consular service and system, but and they always were concerned about their role in screening people to come into the United States and the information that was available to them to carry out those functions. But the real change has been in the much broader political, public, and policy acknowledgement of that role and support for that role that now has really institutionalized the linkage in very broad and lasting ways. So how has that been demonstrated? What have been the implications of this broader linkage of immigration with national security? Well, there have been a series of explicit initiatives that were taken right after 9/11, which are outlined in the fact sheet, and Moose, in following me, is going to pivot off of a few of them a little more fully. What I'd like to do is sketch some of the broader trends that have been a result of this linkage, and I think that there are several that are very important and that are lasting. The first of the broad trends is the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, which took place in legislation in 2002 and actually began to be implemented in 2003. The creation of the Department of Homeland Security as a cabinet agency in the U.S. government represents the largest restructuring that we have had since the Department of Defense was created after World War II. Where immigration is concerned, DHS has incorporated both the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which was part of the Department of Justice, and the Customs Service, which was part of the Department of the Treasury. It broke up those agencies and it recombined them within DHS in new ways, basically creating four fairly autonomous agencies within the Department of Homeland Security. First of those agencies is called Customs and Border Protection, and it integrated the border enforcement and border facilitation functions prior to 9/11 in an effort to create integrated border enforcement for all of U.S. border control. The second of the major agencies is called ICE. It's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It also combined immigration and customs authorities and functions. It focuses on investigation and enforcement of laws within the interior of the United States and internationally in terms of trafficking and document fraud and other kinds of conspiracy and criminal activities that that connect to immigration and customs functions. It also has the responsibility for detention within the United States and removal of people from the United States who are in violation of immigration and customs laws. The third new entity is called USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. That is the agency that deals with benefits and facilitating of legal immigration aspects of our immigration system. It also deals with employer compliance with laws against hiring people that are unauthorized in the United States. And finally, the fourth major new agency is called U.S. Visit, and that is the agency that deals with entry and screening into the country. It's the agency that now collects fingerprints on all non-citizen visitors entering the United States. It is the part of the Department of Homeland Security that works very intensively to sign international agreements with other countries, like-minded countries around the world, to secure travel and mobility and share information and intelligence. The final piece of the immigration picture, visas, and the issuance of visas did not get scooped up in the Department of Homeland Security. It remains in the State Department as a function of the consular service. So what we've seen as a result of this restructuring and of creation of the Department of Homeland Security is four agencies that are highly operational. At the same time, they are, I think it's fair to say, taken together, not dealing very broadly with overall policy development, but focusing much more in a concentrated way on the security and enforcement functions in their missions, and they approach those missions through a security and an enforcement lens. So the second major trend really supports that Department of Homeland Security creation, and that is dramatic growth in the resources that have been allocated for these agencies and for these functions. We have the numbers laid out for you in the fact sheet. I think I just would highlight the dramatic increase in spending. It's 183% from 2002 to 2010 fiscal year. We've gone to a funding at about $19 billion for these functions to today about $55 billion for these functions. It's very dramatic growth. The heaviest concentration of it is in Customs and Border Protection, in other words, in enforcement and control of the borders. And those numbers are more than double, $5 billion to $11 billion. The number that is most often quoted is that the Border Patrol itself now stands at about 20,000-plus people, which is a doubling in just the last 5 years. So the resource growth here is a very big, important part of the story. And that resource growth has been supported on a bipartisan basis by both Democratic and Republican Congresses and both Democratic and Republican presidents. The third major trend is, I think, less well known and a little less well appreciated, and that has to do with databases and the investment in databases and the interoperability and integration of data in federal databases. This is a result of the oft-heard mantra after 9/11 that we needed to connect the dots. Connecting the dots was, of course, one of the major lessons learned out of 9/11, that government agencies were not sharing data effectively in ways that would have allowed for the screening of the hijackers and not granting visas, arguably, to many of them, perhaps all of them. And what the connect the dots and the manifestation in databases and database interoperability represents is a complete flip from the approach prior to 9/11 in the overall view of government and its role with data. Prior to 9/11, the predominant concerns were privacy, individual privacy, and the problems of a Big Brother government. Since 9/11, the value of data, the role that data can play in helping to help the agencies that are responsible for administering immigration laws and other laws has been one of protection and of the value that data can represent in screening purposes, for screening purposes in creating protection for the country. Now, the most fully fledged, I think, manifestation of that data interoperability is the U.S. visit system. It's a large system, which I think is now quite well known around the world, certainly in the United States. And what it allows immigration agents at our borders admitting people to the country to do is to tap into all of the most sensitive intelligence and law enforcement information that the federal government possesses. That kind of capability is also available in a variety of other more specialized systems. One is a system called CVIS, which is the foreign student tracking system that has been put into place. It allows our adjudicators who are looking at asylum applications, who are determining whether people are eligible for naturalization, to have availability to the same kind of information. It is the reason that sometimes we hear of lawful permanent residents who have green cards, who are traveling, trying to reenter the country, being arrested by surprise because the databases now include criminal information that goes far back in time, so somebody may have had a simple marijuana possession conviction, you know, as a teenager, and now many decades later, that information is available and makes that person be vulnerable to removal from the country. So the databases and the integration of the databases has been a very important new capability, which would not likely have been available in as broad a scope as has been the case since 9/11. That has made possible something else, which we hear a great deal about and which you probably follow also, and that is state and local level of government involvement in immigration and in referring immigration cases to the federal government, because now a simple name check at the local police level can and does go to the FBI as it always would have, but that FBI information includes immigration information so that on very normal regular kinds of law enforcement activities at the local level, it is possible for people to be vulnerable to immigration enforcement in ways that had not been the case earlier. The final theme, final trend that I would point to is also connected to this state and local issue, and that is the enormous energy that has gone into local and state government efforts and in some parts of the country to try to pass laws and to pass laws that will allow them to implement immigration laws. Immigration enforcement has always been a province of the federal government, but what we've seen during this post-9/11 period is that even as the resources being poured into immigration enforcement and the national security dimensions of immigration, at the same time, the size of the unauthorized population in the United States also was growing dramatically and has reached record levels. That stopped in about 2000, 2007, 2008 with the recession, and we're now in a period where for the first time in decades, we are not seeing any net growth in the size of the unauthorized population in the United States. But nonetheless, during the period of great growth, there has been a buildup of frustration at the state and local level, frustration that the federal government is perceived as not doing an adequate job of immigration enforcement, and so states have tried to pass laws to take on that authority themselves. Most of those laws have not been implemented. They are in various stages of litigation, but that devolution trend is one that has often been argued for national security purposes, so that the argument that national security is at risk with immigration that is out of control is one that we have heard increasingly throughout the 2000s. It's an argument that has been credible politically at the state and local level, even though ultimately it has been about immigration control as a goal much more than about national security. So the upshot of these large trends is that, in fact, I think it's fair to say that the United States has built an effective response to the immigration national security linkage. The country is in a much stronger position to be effectively screening who it is that is coming into the country, both at the ports of entry and through the visa system. But at the same time, we have looked at all of immigration through the national security prism, not simply the potential terrorist element of it. The result of that has been that other forms of legislation, most particularly comprehensive immigration reform, has been sidelined during this period and is most clearly a victim of the post 9/11 change. The enforcement machinery that has been put into place has tapped into earlier very stringent immigration laws, particularly laws that were enacted in 1996, so that the machinery for immigration enforcement, in doing its work of trying to find the needle in the haystack terrorist circumstance, is also on a day-to-day basis led to much more stringent enforcement in general of immigration, and that, of course, has fallen most heavily on people in the United States who are in an unauthorized status. So let me conclude with those observations and pass it to my colleague, Moose.
Thank you, Doris, and good morning to all of you. Let me begin by focusing on what happened on 9/11. What kind of actions the government took immediately in the aftermath of 9/11. First of all, I think it's important to mention that all the 17 terrorists who attacked us that day were foreign-born, and they were all here on non-immigrant visas of one kind or the other. So immigration as a weapon, as a tool to respond to 9/11 was hardly surprising. In fact, I think given our prior historical encounters with these kinds of attacks, people were expecting that there would be a stronger response to the 9/11 challenge. So let me just for a second say what did not happen in the context of 9/11. If you looked at what the U.S. response was on World War II towards Japanese Americans, or even in World War I towards German Americans, people expected there would be draconian responses with respect to Muslim Americans, both citizens and non-citizens. Luckily, none of the actions that would resemble of our actions in World War II and World War I did not materialize. Obviously, there were no internment camps of Muslims or people from Muslim countries. There were very few actions against U.S. citizens. The government's actions were principally targeted at immigrants. So in terms of, if you remember from our history in Palmer raids and internment camps, none of them panned out in the context of 9/11. Obviously, that is very good news in terms of the maturity of our country. Let me also point out that in terms of the response of the civil society to the challenges of 9/11, it was much more responsive than we had seen in earlier chapters of our national security challenges. Civil rights organizations, human rights organizations, immigrant defense organizations, which had essentially shunned away from representing immigrants and other national security targets in World War I and World War II, were quite active in post 9/11 defense of people who were targets of government actions. From civil liberties organizations to human rights organizations and lawyers from all stripes, we're active from day one in representing the people who had been the targets of the government. So both from the reaction of our government and from the reaction of our civil society, one would have to say that there was a chapter of maturity on the part of the body politic. Having said that, obviously, a lot of terrible things happened after 9/11. And Migration Policy Institute actually issued a reasonably comprehensive report called America's Challenge to look at the immigration actions of the government post 9/11. Let me quickly summarize the categories of those actions. One was that the government immediately after 9/11 started targeting people they perceived to have al-Qaeda contacts or connections. This, unfortunately, inevitably meant that the government was targeting immigrants who had connections to Muslim predominantly or Muslim majority countries, and they happened in various forms. The first was the large detention immediately after 9/11. About 1,200 people were rounded up, and the most important part of that roundup was that they were held in secrecy. Secrecy became one of the important hallmarks of the post 9/11 actions of the government. Even in the Japanese internment camp days, when we arrested people and turned them, we had publicized their names and people would know where they were. In post 9/11 actions, when we rounded up immigrants from mostly Muslim majority countries, their names were not disclosed, their places they were detained were not disclosed. So the secrecy became a very important element of that quick post 9/11 action. We also held many of these in secret proceedings where the government did not open the hearings to the press or to the public. We offered secret evidence, which was not opened to anyone, frequently even to the lawyers. So that was obviously a very important component of 9/11 actions. Second was sort of the conditions and the terms of detention. Large number of people were held without a charge, and large number of people were held for prolonged detention, and large number of people were held even after the charge was dismissed. So the detention terms became a huge focus of 9/11. And the third was that we engaged in set of practices where clearly national origin was the target. And this, again, was immigrants from Muslim-majority countries. This took two or three forms. First, the FBI decided in the first instance to interview about 5,000 adult males from mostly Muslim-majority countries who were here on lawful non-immigrant visas, brought them for interviews to see whether they had any terrorist connections. That was then extended to 3,000 more people, and ultimately we also extended to all Iraqis and Afghans who were living in the U.S. on non-immigrant visas. Now, those FBI interview programs were clearly targeted to individuals from certain countries based on their religion or national origin. Second, we decided that those people who had prior orders of removal would be targeted if they came from certain countries. And again, those countries were Muslim majority countries. The names of those people who had final orders but had not showed up for the removal were put in FBI's database so that if they ever came in contact with law enforcement agents at the street level, that they could be apprehended. Again, to mention, only the names of people who came from Muslim-majority countries were put in that list. And the last one was the most controversial, probably, was what landed up being called the Special Registration Program, where males, adult males from specified countries, and there were about 25, all those 25 countries except North Korea, were Muslim-majority countries where they were not only interrogated and investigated at the ports of entry, but they were also asked to come to specific immigration offices inside the United States for interview and fingerprinting and photographing. Now, these were all obviously what you would call the religious or national origin specific measures. Now, many of these programs or actions did not last very long. Let me quickly recap the current situation with respect to these programs. The secret detention was challenged in federal district courts and was finally the D.C. Circuit Court held that all the secret detentions were constitutional. The government, if it had a law enforcement nexus to withholding people's name, that those names could be withheld. So we don't believe that people are being held in secret detentions any longer, but the fact that government can do it has now been upheld as a post 9/11 legacy. In terms of proceedings being closed to the public, that was also challenged in two separate litigations. And the one district court said that they were constitutional, the other said they were not. The Supreme Court finally decided not to hear the case, and therefore the present position in the country is, except for one circuit court in the Sixth Circuit, that the government can hold secret proceedings if it can convince a judge that there is reason to do that. Again, obviously, a big impact of the post 9/11 actions. And then with respect to prolonged detention of people, that was also challenged by civil liberties groups in the Second Circuit here in New York, finally ruled that prolonged detention was constitutional. So again, the tool that was instituted in the context of 9/11 now is obviously available to the government in the post 9/11 era. There's obviously very good news, I think, on the national origin type of discriminatory actions taken by government. The voluntary interview programs ended. They were not extended after 2003. The putting of names in the absconder, like people who have absconded their final orders of removal, no longer is confined to people from Muslim majority countries, because we now put almost all absconders' names, no matter what their country of origin is in the FBI database. And the last, the most controversial of these, the special registration program, the call-in part of that program was ended in 2003, and the DHS secretary in April of this year terminated all the remaining parts of that program, so that we don't ask people for special registration just because they come from Muslim-dominant countries. So in effect, one would have to say that the programs where national origin or religion was the particular criteria has almost come to an end. There are some remnants of national origin impact with respect to people who may be asking for visas because of the name check. And the name check for people who have Muslim names takes much longer for FBI to clear, because they have to be cleared against very large terrorist databases. And therefore, people with Muslim names still take much longer to get a student visa or a visitor visa than people from non-Muslim countries. That's also true with respect to naturalization applications. It may take Muslims or people with Muslim names much longer to get naturalized than people who don't have those characteristics. But short of that, I think the national origin and religious origin programs have been largely removed. So while that is good news, I think many of the initiatives that were put in place before 9/11, which were targeted at national security and targeted at specific links to people who had al-Qaeda connections, have had, unfortunately, impact on the larger immigrant population. Doris mentioned that how it has obviously derailed the entire consensus on comprehensive immigration reform, which was about to happen by most political calculations in 2001. Obviously, did not even have breathing space till 2006, and then since 2006 has now been marginalized by other political considerations. But it became a big victim of the 9/11 attacks. But I think in addition to the sidelining of the comprehensive immigration reform, the tools that have been put in place in the name of 9/11 threat are now having, obviously, impact on wide sections of the immigrant population, especially the unauthorized. And let me just mention only three Many of you have heard of the Section 287G program, whereby local and state governments are deputized by federal government to enforce certain aspects of our immigration law. Initially, in 2002, started in the state of Florida to go after people who were taking flying lessons, who had obviously some alleged terrorist connections. Now, the activities of the 287G program principally target unauthorized immigrants, and there are now, you know, about 70 such programs around the country with significant impact on people who have obviously no connections to national security. We also have a large fugitive operation program, which is essentially a successor to the old absconder program. Again, the fugitive operation program was sold to Congress in the name of respond to national security, but most of the targets of the fugitive operation programs today are Latino immigrants, and most of them obviously unauthorized. And the third is probably now the largest of the programs, which is the Secure Communities Program, which was started in October of 2008 and now is in operations in about 36 states of the country, expected to go nationwide by 2013, where anyone who is booked into the local jail has that person's fingerprints matched against immigration and criminal history databases, and if there's a match found, those people are then put in immigration proceedings. Again, initially both budgeted and sold as a as an important tool for national security, may no longer have a huge national security import, but has a very large impact on rest of the immigrant community. So in many ways, I think one would, to sum up, one would say that the law, we went into a war footing at the as a response to the 9/11 attacks. Those war footings may no longer have that much relevance to the threats to national security, but they have put in place an arsenal which are now increasingly used to control illegal immigration, both in terms of entry and in terms of removal of people who are in the midst of our society. Thank you.
Great. Doris Moos, thank you very much for those thoughtful comments. We're ready to go to questions now. So if you would like to ask a question, please press *1. And if you want to get out of the queue, if your question has been answered, just go ahead and hit the pound symbol and you'll get out of the queue. So when it's your turn in the queue, you'll hear a message saying your hand is raised and you can go ahead then and start talking. We'd appreciate if you'd start off first by stating your name and your affiliation. And I'll just pause a second here. So *1 if you have any questions. Okay, great. We will go to our first question.
You're online.
Hi, Santiago, I think it's you.
Yes. Hello, yes. Santiago Tabara from Notimex. What changes have you seen in the Latin American region since 9/11 in terms of travel and security? And also, what is the impact of these measures on immigration in the Latino population in relation to hate crimes or discrimination?
Well, in terms of travel within the region, I'm going to take the travel within the region, and was you, I'm going to let you take the second one. I think one of the things that is an outgrowth of 9/11 is much more international cooperation and communication on travel and secure travel and being sure that countries know the identities of people. So that, for instance, even with a country like Mexico that has, you know, was not implicated in any way in the terrorism issue, there has been a lot of cooperation between U.S. authorities and Mexican authorities on airport systems for screening people, for instance. There's a great deal more information exchange that is taking place all around the world in terms of travel and screening systems. A lot of technology upgrades on documents, passports, in the case of the United States, travel cards to cross the northern border, which never was a requirement before, a much more secure border crossing card on the southwest border for people that come in and out of the United States for short periods of time to shop and go to school and so forth. So I do think that the lawful processes and the ability of countries to work together, recognizing that any country is vulnerable to the extent that countries nearby or elsewhere because of the way international travel routes connect us all, have become part of the post 9/11 enterprise.
On the domestic side, I mean, I think it's safe to say that it has a huge impact on the Central American, Latin American immigrant population in the United States, especially the groups of people who may be unauthorized or may have any criminal record of the past. I mean, if you are unauthorized in the United States and living before 9/11, the chances of being detected for removal were very slim. Now we are in a very different enforcement world today because of the post 9/11 policies and programs and databases that have been put in place. So if you're unauthorized, you have to be much more careful than you did before 9/11. The chances that you would be caught by a local cop, and that will lead to removal, is much higher today than it was before 9/11. The fact that you have any criminal record, even a minor one, that may lead to an apprehension, will potentially lead to your removal. The fact that you before 9/11, a large number of unauthorized population could drive by getting a license. Driving and getting a license now has become much more difficult if you're unauthorized. And if you drive on a license that is not validly issued, then you get caught in traffic violations, and traffic violations will lead to removal. So there's obviously much more of the possibility of being apprehended because of the post 9/11 measures than you ever had before the measures were placed in the context of 9/11.
All right, we will go to our next question. Betty, hi, I think it's you.
Hi, Betty Lin of the World Journal. Thank you for this very important call. And, I'd like to know whether you think these trends will continue and how would immigration be played in the election cycle and what kind of suggestions, recommendations you're having. Thank you.
Well, hi, Betty. I do think that these are permanent changes for the near term. I mean, you never know, what could happen in 20 or 10 years. But the importance of these changes is that they have really become institutionalized in government structures. I mean, organizations, the Department of Homeland Security, the way that it is, its mission, the way that these agencies have now been formed, and in funding. I mean, the resources that have flowed into these activities have been really at historic levels. And even if we go into, as we are, a period of greater budget ready, these agencies may not continue to grow at the same rates, but it's unlikely that they will be reduced substantially. So even if they are straight-lined in terms of funding, these are very robust capabilities now that the government possesses. you know, as to the election and going into the election, it's perfectly clear that immigration remains an open issue. It's an unresolved issue in terms of the broader questions of what our immigration policy should be. But in terms of this national security immigration nexus, I think that is broadly accepted. It has been broadly and firmly institutionalized, and I don't see that anybody is particularly questioning that. The issue is, what about the other aspects of immigration beyond national security that have not been addressed? What needs to be done about them, and can the political system address those broader questions? And up until now, that's not been possible.
Let me quickly add, though, one thing. You know, I forgot to mention it in my initial remarks, is that one of the things that did not happen was that people expected, that is, 9/11, we would have a big sort of limits on our immigration. People expected bills to be introduced, either put a moratorium on immigration, or at least moratorium immigration from certain countries of the world. None of that happened. I mean, there was not even a single bill introduced in Congress to put a moratorium on immigration, or to say that immigration from Muslim countries should be stopped for a period of time. And I think that it remains still valid today, is that despite all the 9/11 measures and measures as a result of 9/11, there is still broad consensus in the country about legal immigration. No one has been talking about tinkering with legal immigration. And to the extent actually there is any talk about legal immigration, it is to increase it. Most of our 9/11 activities have to do with targeting criminals, targeting national security risks, and targeting unauthorized immigrants. And actually, even immigration from the Arab countries, Muslim majority countries, has now gone back essentially to the pre-9/11 levels. So even there, we have finally caught up with what the consensus on immigration was before 9/11. So I don't want us to lose that while we are obviously introspecting the effect of our post 9/11 immigration policies.
Great. Well, I think that's an excellent note to end it up on. So thank you very much for joining today's call. The post 9/11 fact sheet is up on our website at migrationpolicy.org. If you have any additional questions or need any information, please feel free to contact me at 202-266-1910, and thank you very much for joining the call today.